Welcome to another edition of the Radio Book Club, a collaboration between KGNU Community Radio and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran. As always, my co-host is Arsen Kashkashian, the head buyer at the Boulder Bookstore. And this week we've been reading a novel from an author who is not known for her works of fiction.
Yes, we're reading Quiet Until the Thaw by Alexandra Fuller. Many people know Alexandra Fuller through her memoirs of her growing up in Rhodesia and her life in Wyoming. And this is her first novel, and I thought it would be great to get her in here and talk about why she wrote a novel, why she wrote fiction, and what the book's about. And I love hearing her speak. I think we're going to have some great accents going at this show.
It's great to have you with us in the studio, Alexandra.
Thank you.
Well, you have made your way to be a resident now in Western US, living in Wyoming for quite a long time now.
Yeah, 23 years, something like that.
And of course, this book is very much deeply rooted in the American West, and we're going to hear a lot more about it. But you've explained why you picked this, so let's get into the nitty-gritty of what the novel is about.
Well, the novel is about Pine Ridge Reservation, and there's several different characters. Rick Overlooking Horse and his cousin, You Choose Watson, who grew up together, are kind of the central characters in the book, and you follow them through many years, and they have very different lives. I guess, you know, as I read the story, I want to know a couple different things. Why did you choose to tell it through fiction, and why did you come upon this story of the Pine Ridge Reservation?
Thank you. You know, I think that I had been coming obliquely, I thought, at fairly directly at race and war and who owns land and indigenous issues, but from a very white perspective in my memoirs. I mean, obliquely toward the US, and that I hope the US reader would look at my memoirs and recognize, get that jolt of recognition that, oh, the same system that operates in Rhodesia feels familiar to me, which is the sort of racial capitalism, you know, a system built on exploitation of land and exploitation of labor, stolen land, stolen labor. And so those things really sort of resonated for me. When I got out to the res, I was sent there on assignment for a magazine, actually, was how it started, having pushed and pushed and pushed every magazine I knew to send me out to the reservation. And that was traditionally, the Lakota territory actually spills into Wyoming, had not the U.S., you know, defaulted on the territory, on the treaties of 1851. So for me going out there, it was as well, I think as an immigrant especially, whose land am I on? I mean, I think I come at it as an immigrant and also a very aware white settler. I mean, there weren't generations and generations between me and the violence of my white settler ancestors. I was the white settler that was the violence, I mean, during the Bush War in Rhodesia. So for me, when I got onto the res, there was this horrible singing resonance of what I understood this to be. I mean, I knew this was like the homelands in South Africa, or like the tribal trust lands in Rhodesia. I mean, you see that stamp and you know what it is. And for me, going at it in fiction form, I think allowed me to go more head on, weirdly, than I think nonfiction does. Because nonfiction, you have to be so careful that you're supporting the character. You feel this responsibility that you understand humans are so complex and complicated. Fiction, I think, allows you to write what you know fully about someone and allows you to write about people who maybe wouldn't give you access to their story. So a character like You Choose Watson, who's a sort of drug addict and a really violent person, that would be a difficult thing to get in a sort of nonfiction interview. It's possible, but it's difficult. And so this to me felt like a way in.
In terms of your background writing memoirs, you're writing your own story, and there's a certain safety in that because it's your story. You're the one who has ownership of that. When you're telling other nations' stories, other races' stories, how much weight does that put on you as a writer, given what you've just explained about being very aware of the white settler narrative and your own experience in Africa?
I mean, I'm condemned out of my own pen. I completely accept the charge. I think it's and a vital one to make. I mean, I think this is where we are, that it's important that we understand that the white settler has, you know, took, we know, the land, the water, the air, and the dominant narrative. And so for me, I think the decision to come it's not a decision at a certain point. There was this just, I think, sense that had, you know, and had there been the luxury for an outpouring of narrative from the res, yes, I can't ever replace that. But what is terrifying is that conditions on the res don't allow for storytellers necessarily in the way that we, you know, how pushy you have to be, and how much space and peace it requires to write. So life expectancy on the res is between 46 and 48 for men, 52 for women, and the annual income is $4,000 a year. Now, how you can write a book, how do you do that? Let alone also sort of hold on to, you know, this precious culture that's under such assault. And the thing I think you have to be very careful of as a settler writer is not to do that thing where you project, first of all of your guilt and then insist on all of the healing in return. Because ironically, that is what's happening. That is the place that we're at, I think, as white settlers in this country. We understand we're at an impasse, that we've really messed up environmentally, that our land and our water's in danger, our topsoil blows, you know, off regularly. And that the people to whom we need to turn for advice are the very people whom we recently tried to kill. That is a very difficult relationship.
Even your choice of language shows a level of awareness that I really have never heard, even from people in the US who talk a lot about race, even the use of the term white settler. And I know that very much harks back to your experience in Africa. We don't use that terminology here in the US, and yet it seems so incredibly appropriate, particularly now in 2017.
Well, and that I think is where immigrants are very valuable, because we bring eyes that say, oh, at home we call this, that's what this is. And we're not in the trance or the propaganda trance of the country that we're in, because the one thing that the US has done, I think, really well has sold itself as a free nation, land of the free, home of the brave. Neither of which turns out to be true. We're objectively unfree. I mean, anytime you have disparity that we see in this nation, where black communities, you know, are expected to drink lead-laced water, and where our indigenous communities are living with the same demographic statistics as Haiti, that is an organized political managed, you know, that's an arrangement, and it's propped up usually by heavy military, and you don't have to be a political scientist to look around and see how heavily militarized we are in the US and how heavily militarized our response to resistance from communities of color or indigenous communities is. I mean, anyone who disbelieves that should go back and look at the footage from Standing Rock, where a very peaceful set of protesters were met as if they were a terrorist threat. And as a U.S. citizen, I think you have to educate yourself about what language is appropriate there. And one way to do it is to ask the Lakota, and they will call you a white settler. Oh, that's what I am.
Yeah, you talk about the Indian Wars really as continuing, whether it's the early 70s with AIM and up to today with Standing Rock. And that plays a factor in the book, that this is continuing. We like to think it's over in some way, but it's not. This violence goes on and on, doesn't it?
And the violence is on behalf of us. I mean, we're the ones who have instigated it. From the white settler point of view, which is who is most widely represented in our government? I mean, who has the bulk of the power? If you look at who is sitting in our Congress and in our White House, that looks a lot like white supremacy to me. And as an immigrant coming here and seeing segregation so blatantly, I remember saying to my ex-husband, who's from the East Coast, he's from Philadelphia mainline family.
And I'm from Bucks County. We're a little different.
And I remember sort of pointing out, I sort of saying, gosh, you know, this is, you know, just so you know, apartheid didn't end in the States. This is, still looks alive and well to me. And he explained very kindly that no, he had had an Italian neighbor growing up. And, you know, then I think I was still too sort of fogged by where I was, having just sort of got here, to realize, oh, there is all different codes, you know, for racism in the States too. You know, I'd gotten used to our codes in Rhodesia, which were a little more blunt. And in the States, coded racism is very entre nous, very particularly among the neoliberal groups, the sort of latte-sipping, freedom-loving. And, you know, I think having grown up, having to, I don't know, experience my own racism, my own white supremacy through the prism of a Bush war, I mean, that was not a trivial way to experience your own, you know, pathological understanding of the world that had been given to me by my parents and my government, my priests, my teachers. But having an understanding of it gives me this very blunt language because I live so much in terror of a repeat of that experience.
We're speaking with author Alexandra Fuller this morning on the Radio Book Club, a monthly collaboration between KGNU Community Radio and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran with KGNU. Arsene Kashkashian with the Boulder Bookstore, as always, is my co-host. And today we're talking about Quiet Until the Thaw by Alexandra Fuller. And it's a novel, quite a departure from her previous books, which have been memoirs. But this is still very much rooted in your own experience. You live in Wyoming and have done for many years, but you spent a lot of time on the Pine Ridge Reservation. How did you come to be there and what was that experience like?
So I had written for a long time for National Geographic, which I now, you know, will not do. I consider them part of the dominant narrative that I'm trying to deconstruct. And it became clearer and clearer to me that I was, you know, that I was participating in that dominant narrative, as long as, you know, my words needed to be filtered through the sort of fact-checking department, which was really code for, can we bend this narrative to a way that is more palatable to our readers who are used to hearing a very white kind of narrative? And so for me, completely deconstructing that was an important sort of step in all of this, but I came to it, I would say, rather dishonestly on assignment from National Geographic. But when in retrospect, we came onto the res in the most honest way possible, which was that the photographer who was doing the story with me for National Geographic, a brilliant Wyoming photographer called Aaron Huey, who I strongly suggest people research his work. He is a genius, and he had been on the res for 6 years. And he and I participated in an annual ride from Fort Robinson, Nebraska, to the res, the place of Crazy Horse, the great chief Crazy Horse's death, toward the res, the journey that Crazy Horse himself was never allowed to make. And, you know, 400 Lakota Indian for 200 miles across country on the most difficult horses in incredible heat. And having, I'm not an untough person. I mean, I was raised by my mother, a submachine toting alcoholic Southern African white supremacist. I was roped by the end of a single day. I mean, the toughest, most amazingly sort of, I was so humbled before I even got to the res. I think that's the appropriate way to show up, I guess is what I'm saying.
How long then did you spend on the reservation?
And then I spent the 3 months and there's a wonderful school, the Red Cloud School, that is near the old Indian boarding school that was on the res. I mean, again, I so strongly encourage people to humbly go to where Indigenous people have been forced to live and to see things like these Indian schools. I mean, to see for themselves the mass graves and to really find out from themselves what the history is from the Indigenous perspective, because that narrative hasn't been told. And so staying out in an old boarding school for 3 months, which was the most ghosted place, it was incredible. It was, I mean, it changed my life because I will never see this country the same way. It became an undeniable truth where I was living and what system I was living in.
Well, I think, you know, growing up on the East Coast in the Philadelphia area, I had no idea what was happening in the West until I moved out here a couple years before you did in the early 90s and started. I've been to a lot of the Pueblos down in New Mexico. I haven't been to Pine Ridge. Last year, I had an interesting experience. We were in South Dakota at a town called Hot Springs, and we found this natural pool in this creek. And we were swimming there, and four or six people came from the Pine Ridge Reservation. And we just spent the day kind of swimming with them and two other tourists who were crossing the country. And it was an interesting experience. But when you grow up in this country, especially in the East Coast, it's like it doesn't exist. It's like you don't see this aspect of what the power is doing in this country. And I think that's very interesting. It's so hidden. It's not in the books. It's history. It's not living anymore.
Well, and I think that we make a big mistake if we forget on the East Coast that there is plenty of living Indian history. I mean, living Indian life. I mean, that this thing is not, I mean, we are so brainwashed. I think it is such an important strategy on behalf of ensuring the obliteration of this, you know, indigenous nations, that we as the dominant culture are given the most slender and sort of biased view of it in the schools. And I know this because I have three children between the ages of 24 and 11. So I know what they're getting taught in school, and I most certainly supplement that education and make sure my children know you are standing on native ground. I mean, I do not want to repeat the sins of my ancestors, because in this lifetime, you know, I think it is my job to make sure that violence ends with me. And this book changed me for that. I mean, I think even living in the West and having some experience, you know, I volunteered in a school and taught kids from the Arapaho and Shoshone Nations on the Wind River Reservation. So I had had some tiny introduction to it, but like you, you know, no real deep sort of immersion. What a heartbreaking hole in our human story. And what a heartbreaking hole in our human understanding of spirit and what is possible and a way of understanding this earth. And the problem is, all of those are tropes, by the way, that white settlers use, you know, to sort of, I think, parasite off of indigenous communities. Oh, they're so attached to seasons and land and wisdom, and or they're raging alcoholics and corrupt. And in a way, those tropes are what I brought to this book in order to dismantle them, that actually, from the perspective, at least from this white settler going through the res, it was literally mind-blowing and affirming and completely changed the way that I live, weirdly. I mean, the novel had the effect of greatly reducing my material ambition.
So you get into this community in the novel through a lot of characters, but most explicitly Rick Overlooking Horse and You Choose Watson, who then becomes You Choose What Son. Could you tell us about those characters and how you use them as a window maybe to start exploring this these people?
Yeah, thanks, Arsene. And Maeve, you know, you mentioned this nonfiction fiction. I mean, I have to say, weirdly, fiction for me is way more real than any memoir I've written. I could get to the heart of, you know, my own trauma, which is a mild, mild trauma. My trauma is, you know, the flip side of the coin to the oppression that I was raised with. But the oppressors, too, are traumatized. I mean, you only have to look at opioid addiction in this country among white settler children to see that we are doing it, we have done it. That this pain, you feel it, whether or not you're aware of it, however angry or enraged or hating you are. That's a form of pain. I mean, we're all sort of in it. And so for me, getting into the characters of sort of quote-unquote Lakota, you know, people, I mean, what white settler woman now embodies this character of Rick Overlooking Horse? But I had met a wonderful Lakota leader out on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation called Alex Whiteplume. He and his wife, Deborah Whiteplume, are amazing resistance couple, you know, really stand up for American Indian rights. And so Rick Overlooking Horse, if I shut my eyes, I could imagine Alex and Deborah Whiteplume as sort of every single thing they told me, one of which Alex Whiteplume, you know, I would be frantically writing notes. And Alex Whiteplume said to me one day, "You don't trust yourself, do you?" I said, "What do you mean?" And I'm also writing that down. He goes, "You can't stop writing to listen. That is one way you white people have a barrier. You record everything. No trust." And I put my pencil down after that and wanted to write the book as if Alex Whiteplume's instruction was primary, which is listen. Don't try and read this and deconstruct it and kill it. Don't kill that word on the page. Listen. This is a prose poem. And then my father had recently died when I was writing Rick Overlooking Horse, and he had done so much work to deconstruct his own white supremacy in real time, you know, starting from being the aggressor in the Rhodesian Bush War to, when he died, being a greatly humbled man and with almost monkish existence living in Zambia. And so a lot of that distilled understanding that you have, I believe, is the same on either side of the coin, and any warrior will tell you that. When you age, your enemy becomes your closest friend, that you understand their mind like nobody else's. And so my father, weirdly, came to me a lot in the character of Rick Overlooking Horse.
I wanted you to read a little bit to give people a sense of the book. It's a novel, but it's a novel in sketches. It's a novel in short pieces, and it's a novel that doesn't always stick with the characters, or you get philosophical, or you go back in history, or you know, it goes all over the place in a very, very satisfying way, I should tell the audience. I really love this book. But I want you to read a chapter where you kind of bring in some of the history and some of the most familiar Indian images that we have in this country.
Italians/Indians, crossed out, cry too. Before the Keep America Beautiful campaign that showed Chief Iron Eyes Cody shed a single tear when he saw the mess the white man had made of the earth, it was commonly believed by non-Indians that Indians didn't cry. Sure, in historical depictions they looked defeated and slumped over their war ponies. And if you paid attention to modern photographs, they looked pretty binged out. But you never thought of Indians as sad, per se. You thought of them as stoic. Skipping lightly over the fact that Chief Iron Eyes Cody wasn't a real Indian at all, not Cherokee Cree, as he claimed, he was in fact of Italian descent. What it did show is that Indians were mostly whatever other people needed them to be. The fact is, even with just one eye, Rick Overlooking Horse cried tears like a river for Billy Mills. Not just tears of joy because that Indian had run like the wind and shown the world the power of his mind and the power of his body, but also because Rick Overlooking Horse knew Billy Mills had been through the literal definition of hell to earn those wings. I mean, what were the odds? A half-breed orphan raised in poverty in the 1950s on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, who nonetheless survived boarding school and got an athletic scholarship to the University of Kansas, and who had once stood on the edge of a hotel window after a college track meet and considered his body in flight, or really in free fall, without wings, and somehow decided against it. Can the Dark One step out of the picture? The photographer had asked that afternoon. In the end, when he had won the gold medal and everyone wanted him for their hero, they couldn't put the Dark One into enough pictures. They made movies about him and wrote books and built a community hall in Pine Ridge Village in his honor, and they gave him a Lakota name, Makatatakahela, meaning respects the earth, which became inconvenient for the U.S. government trying their best to staunch the burgeoning environmental and peace and love and tolerance movement sweeping across the land. Loves his country, they decided was a better, more patriotic-sounding translation of the phrase, more in keeping with their needs.
That's Alexandra Fuller reading from her new novel, Quiet Until the Thaw. It's been our selection this month on the Radio Book Club, a collaboration between KGNU Community Radio and the Boulder Bookstore. Billy Mills, who is referenced in that particular point, an Olympic athlete. Tell us the story of Billy Mills, because I found that narrative incredibly powerful. And just what you say there about how oppressed all his life, but then once he makes the name for himself on an international stage, then the US wants to commodify him, but once again shape him for their own benefit.
And my background is in nonfiction, and I wrote for National Geographic, who fact check everything to death. So much of this book is the historical stuff I dragged. I mean, I did the research and I pulled those quotes, an actual quote, would the Dark One step out of the picture? And Billy Mills actually that night stood on the ledge of his hotel window and contemplated suicide. And I think what I'm trying to demonstrate is we all lose Billy Mills by asking him to step out of the picture, by asking Black Lives Matter to quieten it down, to ask for us all to be civil right now. It's, you know, we're back in this moment. We never left this moment. This moment just evolved. Slavery never ended. It evolved. You know, our war, the Indian wars were never over. And Billy Mills is such a beautiful example of that. I so encourage listeners to go and Google Billy Mills's interviews about that 1964 run for the Gold Olympics. He was asthmatic. He grew up in poverty. And his mother died when he was very young. So he was, you know, more or less orphaned. His father was around until he was a little bit older, but not much. But his father always said to him, just remember you have wings of an eagle. And as he was running that race, he could hear, you know, and he was the complete underdog. No one expected him to win. Wings of an eagle.
One of the things that Billy Mills experienced was the boarding schools, and that narrative of stolen children along with the stolen land is still such a rip in the Native American experience, part of the destruction essentially of the fabric of families, of culture, of everything. And it runs through all of the characters. All of the characters at one point had been stolen, and these weren't orphanages. These weren't places. These were children were stolen from the reservation. And there's a scene where the kids are running away from the people who have come to the reservation to steal them from their families and put them in these schools.
When I was on the res, one of the things that struck me one day, it was incredibly hot, you know, midsummer, and boreal frogs croaking, it's humid. It reminded me a lot of places I've lived in Africa. And there had been a group of young men I had befriended, or gotten to know slightly over the summer. Anyway, one day I was driving and I saw four of them running in the heat as fast as they could, stripped to the waist. So of course I stopped my car, give you guys a lift. They said, we're in training. We're in training for when they come. And I said, who? And they said, have you not been paying attention? And one of the things that they told me about afterwards was that they train and run over the hills because a cop car eventually can't chase you over the hills. Imagine, we're in, you know, at that point, this was 2011 that I was out on the res. We still have children training themselves to run from the police on native land. That should tell us something. And demographically, Native Americans are killed by police in this country at the highest rate of any other ethnicity, and yet they fight for us in the military at the highest rate of any other ethnicity. You know, so all of this is in there, the boarding schools, the pursuit, I mean, of what is this? And I think also a very dominant narrative that says, if you're not me, you're a failed attempt to be me. I mean, I think that's a very sort of white American idea that somehow the pinnacle of achievement is to look like you got it all. And that is the absolute antithesis of Lakota achievement, which is to share all with the community. No wonder, you know, just by proximity, I think it's a kind of constant attempt to stave off death by cultural assimilation, if nothing else.
Within this narrative where, you know, so much is, the oppression is so bad, the poverty is so bad, one of the main things in this book, though, is I don't want to use the word forgiveness, because I think you say in here that Lakota don't exactly have a word for forgiveness. But in the end, with the act of violence that kind of defines the end of the book, there is an act of forgiveness, an act of allowing the person who committed the violence back into the family of the community.
Right. And I think one thing that needs to be deeply understood is that the people who have processed the completely abusive relationship that they're in, and this enmeshed relationship that they're in with the U.S., understand and allow back in to the fold people who have committed unconscious acts of violence against themselves that becomes against their community. I mean, we make such a mistake to think that, you know, our own, we do it. The white settler community do it on steroids. We just don't let people back in once they've, you know, quote unquote, crossed the line. And yet the Lakota way is, all right, you did that part of your journey. And now your journey continues. You're not forever stuck in the moment of your violent reaction to what your body must express, which is the grief and violence of so many hundreds of years of oppression against you.
There's so much to talk about. And one of the things, and we will get into this more in the podcast version of this, because we do have after hours at the book club, and we're hoping Alexandra will indulge us a little bit more. The writing is so beautifully sparse and yet conveys such power and emotion. And I can tell just from, you know, your body language here and the emotion that you still feel as part of this book, and you convey so much of that with such simple language. And I don't mean simple in any kind of negative way. It's just very powerful and right down to the core, the essence.
I think that when the lesson really hit me that, listen, wow, we have a lot to learn here. And I've been writing for a long time, and I've read it, I don't know, hundreds of readings in this country, and it is so rare that there is ever someone of color, let alone an indigenous person, at my readings. Once by accident, two women of color showed up at a reading in Portland because they thought I was the next week, and they politely sat through the thing. But this really strikes me as a white settler here that, oh, this feels a lot like South Africa, where the audiences are all white, where we're an echo chamber. And I'm realistic about the fact that we're in this echo chamber, that I am taking a white settler audience onto the res. I don't expect, I mean, if Indigenous people have the time or whatever to read this book, there's nothing I can say there. But to the white settler audience, yes, I can say this. This is my entrance, I guess. And so for me, it was critical that I be essential because I wanted to write only what I knew. And it wasn't much. I mean, I really cannot know much about, you know, Native American Indigenous culture, not all the way through. And I didn't want to inadvertently give away anything that wasn't mine to tell. So for me, this was the essential part was, this is going to make me sound like a sort of show-offy Zen Buddhist. I assure you I am nothing like this. But I would meditate for about 4 hours, maybe write for two, because I would have one or two true things that would come out of these long, exhaustive meditation sessions where a lot of what I was doing was unpicking my own toxic, white supremacist, racist mind and sifting through it for any strains left of that violence from my childhood and making sure that didn't make it onto the page.
But it's a beautifully written book and it's a wonderful read. Quiet Until the Thaw is the new novel by Alexandra Fuller. Thank you. Well, as we always do at the end of the book club segment, Arsene, we give a shout out to our upcoming book. So on July 27th, we're going to be discussing Girl in Snow. We're inviting listeners to read along with us. And this is a local author.
Yeah, Danya Kukovka. She, I believe, was raised in Fort Collins, and she's now an assistant editor at Riverhead, which is an imprint at Penguin. And this is her first novel, and it's about a community trying to come together or secrets being revealed after the death of a girl in the community. So I'm really looking forward to having her on, and I'm, you know, excited that we have somebody who's local with a, you know, another novel. It's great. We have so many great Colorado authors, and Wyoming, Alexandra's just right next door.
Read along with us, Girl in Snow, and do check out After Hours at the Book Club on iTunes or any podcast service or at news.kgnu.org. Thank you so much. The Radio Book Club is a monthly collaboration between the Boulder Bookstore and KGNU. Arsene Kashkashian with the Boulder Bookstore, as always, my co-host, and I'm Maeve Conran.